listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we've been hearing a lot about efforts to flatten the curve of new coronavirus cases. But what does that mean? What is it going to look like in Wisconsin? New reporting from WisContext gives us a closer look. First, earlier this month, we marked the 9-year anniversary of the passage of Act 10, which created major limits on public employee unions in Wisconsin. We talked about the impact of Act 10 with Brett Healy, president of the John K. MacIver Institute for Public Policy. By his group's calculations, he said Wisconsin has saved more than $12 billion in retirement and health care costs over the 9 years. David Madlin joins us now for another perspective on the impact of Act 10. He's senior fellow and strategic director of the American Worker Project at the Center for American Progress. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thanks very much for having me.
You wrote a report, this is a couple years back, looking at the impact of Act 10 on education in Wisconsin. What were some of the things that you and your colleagues found?
Yeah, so when we looked at the data, what we found was that after Act 10, not surprisingly, the compensation for teachers fell, and that was both wages as well as their benefits, especially their pension benefits. And then critically, we found that that lower compensation had led to increased turnover. So you were seeing especially more experienced teachers leaving the profession, and also that it was harder to find people to replace them. So there was generally a less experienced workforce. And this also, the last element, so you know, lower compensation and greater turnover, and then this suggested there was also declining quality of education because teacher experience is sort of one of the best predictors of quality of education, and then the test results were also showing a downward trend, and some academic research subsequently also found similar results. So I think the basic results are that, you know, Act 10 has harmed workers and it's also harmed the public.
People have made the case that some of these stories with teachers retiring, high turnover, trouble getting people into the profession is a national story. Did you see more so that happening in Wisconsin than the rest of the nation?
Well, there is. It's both a national problem and an especially acute problem in Wisconsin. You know, the teacher profession doesn't pay in a lot of states. And so that's clearly part of the problem. But Wisconsin has been acutely actually cutting, you know, decreasing overall compensation so that far fewer people are wanting to go into the profession. The number of, you know, people in the pipeline to be teachers has decreased significantly. The amount of emergency certifications increased significantly. So, yes, it is both a national problem, but Wisconsin has not has made the problem worse by passing Act 10 and the subsequent budget cuts.
Now, our guest earlier this month with the MacIver Institute, they had done a study trying to tally the cost savings from Act 10. As I mentioned, lots of money, $12 billion in retirement and health care costs. What do you make of that argument that, okay, we may have had these consequences, but we've saved a lot of money that we're using for hopefully better purposes in Wisconsin?
I think the for better purposes is the big problem. You know, unfortunately, the for better purposes were for tax cuts for the wealthy and for large corporations. Even, you know, right after Act 10 passed, the Governor Walker at the time, then in the same year, rolled out a bunch of tax cuts, and then subsequently, you know, deals like Foxconn. So it's you're squeezing workers, which not surprisingly is impacting the quality of public services, and then giving money away to those at the very top who in this economy are not the people who need help. It's sadly based on this really flawed theory, trickle-down economics, that if you give those at the top more, that's somehow going to be good for everyone else. And it has not proven true. It's wages have continued to stagnate. No faster growth. You know, when you compare Wisconsin to its neighbors, for example, slower growth. So it's really been a flawed experiment.
Talking to David Madlin from the Center for American Progress, looking at the impact of Act 10 here in Wisconsin. This month marks 9 months since it was passed. It severely restricted the ability of public workers to organize unions. David, one argument is, hey, if we've got public workers unionizing, they're bargaining for better pay, better benefits. That ultimately comes at a cost to taxpayers. It raises the costs of government. What's wrong with dialing that back?
Well, that should be a negotiation between the parties, the public, government, and the workers, between sort of what's the amount of public services we want and how much it should cost. By taking away workers' right to join together, which is a right that's sort of recognized, you know, that people should be able to join together and negotiate, you have stripped people of a fundamental right. You've also weakened the state as a whole because you aren't providing the same quality of services anymore. And you can't. When workers are not able to have a seat at the table, it's unfortunately too often a dictate from the top, and the people at the top don't always know what's right. It should be a negotiation, a balanced negotiation between each party. Each party has something to offer, and when you take away the workers' voice to be part of those negotiations, you lose out.
We heard back in the time of Act 10's passage, arguments from people who worked in the private sector saying, hey, you know, I don't have a union. I don't have the kind of rights you're talking about. Why should our public workers have it if so many of us don't?
Well, actually, all workers should have rights to join a union. And unfortunately, those rights are too weak for all workers. But at least most private sector workers still have some rights to collectively bargain. They need to be changed and improved and strengthened. But unfortunately, that requires federal action. The state of Wisconsin controls the rights that public sector workers have, and it shouldn't take away those rights to supposedly equalize things. And the other sort of kind of arguments that get thrown in here is, you know, when you compare the salaries or total compensation between public sector employees and private sector employees, when you compare people with similar educations, you actually find that private sector workers have generally lower overall compensation. They tend maybe have slightly better pensions and things like that, but their wages are lower, and that the overall compensation is lower. So it's a really bad form of downward leveling. You're pulling down everyone to a really low level rather than lifting everyone up. And at this moment, what we really need is kind of a lifting up. Wages have been stagnant for decades. You know, the typical male worker is making about the same as they were in the 1970s. So unions and collective bargaining are a critical piece of raising up standards for all workers.
Act 10 was a big fight here in Wisconsin. It was a big milestone here in Wisconsin. Do you see it as a big deal at the national level? Did it set other dominoes falling around the country?
Yes, it certainly was a big deal. A couple other states, most notably Iowa, but several others, passed similar kinds of legislation to take away collective bargaining rights for workers. And the Supreme Court has also followed with some similar decisions to weaken collective bargaining, and members of Congress have introduced similar legislation. I think finally the tide has turned. There was a couple of years where it was sort of all sorts of bills to kill and weaken unions, but especially in the past couple of years, you know, there were the West Virginia teacher strikes, where for decades they'd had stagnant or declining funding for education. Teachers' salaries are way too low. They were cutting their health care and benefits. Teachers working at fast food places just to make ends meet. And they got fed up, and teachers across the country in a number of different states came together and struck and started to fight for better education for all people, for not only higher salaries but more investments in public education. And so I think that's part of the tide turning, and you're seeing in Congress bills that passed the House recently, for example, to increase workers' rights to join unions. You know, there's a long ways to go. Those bills haven't become law yet, but I think there's a big tide turning towards recognizing the value unions deliver, and polls showing more and more workers would like to join unions. A majority of workers would like to do so, but unfortunately our laws make that very difficult. So, yes, it sparked a national Act 10 sparked sort of a national debate, first to weaken unions, and now I think it's part of the backlash to that is actually about how do we actually strengthen unions and restore balance in our economy.
David, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me.
That's David Madlin, Senior Fellow and Strategic Director of the American Worker Project at the Center for American Progress. We talked to him today about the impact of Act 10 in Wisconsin 9 years after it was passed. We heard from a guest earlier this month who made the case that Act 10 was a good idea. He cited cost savings. You can find that conversation at npr.org/centraltime. Coming up, we'll talk about Wisconsin's hospital capacity to deal with the coronavirus outbreak and find out how prepared different parts of the state may be. Stay with us here on Central Time. Right. Coming up, Congress is looking to pass its biggest economic relief package yet in an effort to offset the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll find out what's in it and how Republicans and Democrats reached a compromise. First, Governor Evers officially unveiled an order yesterday telling Wisconsinites to stay at home as the state continues to deal with the outbreak of the coronavirus. In a briefing yesterday, Andrea Palm, Secretary Designee of the State Department of Health Services, explained why that move was needed.
If we continue on our current path without implementing Safer at Home to flatten the curve, the models show us that we would likely have 22,000 Wisconsinites who are positive for COVID-19 by April 8th, and an estimated 440 to 1,500 deaths. This means thousands of Wisconsinites would need hospitalization, and we would exceed our current capacity, our current hospital bed capacity.
The phrase flatten the curve has been coming up a lot, and our colleagues at WisContext recently took a closer look at what that phrase actually means and what the efforts look like here in Wisconsin. Will Cushman is the associate editor of WisContext. Will, thanks a lot for being back with us.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Let's start off with this curve. I think everybody's probably heard the phrase flatten the curve. If we've heard it and don't know what we're talking about, what does that mean?
Yeah, I think that's good to get on the same page right away. So the curve that we're talking about is kind of what an outbreak of a respiratory disease like COVID-19 looks like when it's plotted over time. So it's basically like a graph, or it is a graph. And so when an outbreak of a disease like COVID-19 is just getting started and it's really contagious and it is spreading rapidly and there are rapidly rising infections, the graph of that outbreak over time appears to steepen. And so there's a curve. And when it gets really steep, then the curve is quite steep itself.
And that means that a lot of cases of this are happening, a lot of people then being hospitalized, presumably. And so the idea of flattening the curve is hopefully to slow down the pace at which people get sick and end up in the hospital. Is that really at the core of this?
Exactly. Flattening the curve doesn't necessarily indicate that fewer people will get sick with COVID-19 over time, over the whole length of the outbreak. But what it means is that there are fewer people getting sick with COVID-19 at the same time and also really quickly. So flattening the curve just basically means that the rate of new infections is slowing.
You dug in this piece for WisContext into our hospital capacity here in Wisconsin. What kind of things did you look at?
Yeah, looked at a whole bunch of things. We looked at basic data about just hospital beds in general. Also, we were very interested in the number of ICU beds in the state because we know that a lot of patients who do require hospitalization, which is a minority of the people who get COVID-19, it's about maybe 1 in 5, 1 in 6 patients require hospitalization, but a good portion of those patients require ICU care. And also, we were interested in the status of ventilators in the state because we know from watching the outbreak as it's progressed around the world that a number of those very sick people require mechanical ventilation, basically life support, in order to stay alive. And so what we've found is that Wisconsin has, it kind of depends on how you count it, and this data is not perfect. And I should say that a lot of hospitals have been beefing up capacity in recent weeks in preparation for an outbreak. But we found that Wisconsin has roughly 17,000 to 18,000 non-psychiatric hospital beds in the state. We also found out recently from Secretary Designee Palm that the state has about 2,500 ICU beds and a little over 600 mechanical ventilators as of right now.
And an important part of the story is that these beds are not necessarily sitting there empty waiting for COVID-19 victims, right? They are the beds that hospitals are using for the stuff they do on a daily basis.
Exactly. Like, as we heard in that recording from Secretary Designee Palm yesterday, when she was talking about what models were showing would happen if we kind of went about daily life as usual in Wisconsin over the coming weeks, she said something like over 20,000 potential cases of COVID-19 in the state by early April. And someone might hear that and then hear, oh, well, we have 17 or 18,000 hospital beds. Most of those people who get sick won't even need hospitalization in the first place, so we should be fine, right? But really, the number of hospital beds that we have at any given time about half of the beds are being used at any given time. Actually, in reality right now, a much higher percentage of hospital beds in Wisconsin are being used. We're coming out of we're still dealing with a pretty heavy influenza season. Hospital bed use right now is quite high. I've heard from the fire chief in Green Bay last week that hospital beds, 97% of the hospital beds in the city were in use last week. So there isn't a whole lot of free space right now.
Will Cushman is with us from Wisconsin. Context about the capacity of hospitals in Wisconsin to deal with a potential influx of patients because of the COVID-19 disease. Will, you did different scenarios. You've got them charted out there at wiscontext.org, looking at if things like 10% of Wisconsinites get this, 20% and so on. How quickly do we end up hitting that capacity?
Yeah, we took data from some models that came out of the Harvard Global Health Institute. They worked with the New York Times and ProPublica on disseminating some of this modeling that they've done, and then they provided all their data for free to anyone to use it, which is great for us. What is not so great is kind of what those models show the potential impact of COVID-19 being on the state of Wisconsin. So yeah, as you said, they model kind of if the outbreak were to infect 20% of adults or 40%, or in the case of a bad outbreak, 60% of adults, how much hospital bed capacity would be required. But they actually drill even deeper and look at if these outbreaks of varying severity they wanted to model like what these outbreaks would look like under various conditions, including kind of normal going about daily life normally conditions, and then under pretty extreme social distancing conditions, such as what we are experiencing in Wisconsin right now under the Safer at Home order. And what they found is that even under the best case scenarios, where we are practicing social distancing pretty religiously and slowing down the outbreak of COVID-19, and under a scenario where a minority of adults contract the disease, even then, in some regions within the state, hospitals would be pretty strained. Under worst case scenarios, where we don't practice a whole lot of social distancing, the outbreak expands super rapidly, and 60% of adults contract COVID-19 really quickly, hospital systems across the state would be really quickly overwhelmed. For instance, the region around Appleton, these models show there would be so many patients requiring hospitalization that it would be exceeding the region's capacity by 500%.
You, as you mentioned, you looked by region and by county. Did other areas stand out to you, Will, when you broke it down by county?
Yeah, so I broke down just the hospital beds per capita by county. So that's the number of hospital beds per 1,000 residents. The state overall has about 3.1 hospital beds per 1,000 residents. That's a little bit better than the national average of about 2.8 beds per 1,000 residents. A kind of interesting or potentially frightening aside Italy, which we know is dealing with a horrendous outbreak right now, has about 3.2 hospital beds per 1,000 residents. So it's just slightly higher than the state of Wisconsin. There are a whole lot of things that kind of complicate comparisons between Wisconsin and Italy. Our populations are quite different. The way our health systems work is different. But at a kind of fundamental level of capacity, it's a little frightening to see that statistic. There are places in the state where there is quite a bit more capacity. For instance, Wood County, which is home to the Marshfield Clinic, has about 10 beds per 1,000 residents. Milwaukee is doing a little bit better than the state average with a little over 4 beds per 1,000 residents. There are a whole bunch of rural counties that have 0 beds because there are no hospitals there. And then there's some counties around the state's borders that also have kind of lower rates of hospital beds. But a lot of times that's because people in those counties seek care across state lines.
So, Will, big picture, looking at your reporting, it seems like we're racing against the clock here, trying to slow the spread of the disease at the same time as hospitals and other facilities ramp up their efforts. That's what this is all about, right?
It is, yep. And that's what the safer at home order, closing the schools, all these kind of restrictive orders that are supposed to be encouraging social distancing is really getting at, is trying to slow the spread, which is both to give hospitals and healthcare systems more time to prepare, to try to expand their capacity as much as possible, procure as much personal protective gear as they can. Procure as much equipment like ventilators as they can, whether it's from the federal government or elsewhere. But then it's also about making sure that there are just not so many people sick with COVID-19 at the same time that even with the best preparations, the amount of sick patients just completely swamping hospitals. We do not want that, obviously.
Will, thanks for joining us. We'll keep watching your reporting.
Great. Thanks a lot, Rob.
That's Will Cushman, associate editor of WisContext. He was with us today to talk about his latest piece on efforts to flatten the curve of coronavirus cases in Wisconsin. You can find that on the website, wiscontext.org. Coming up after the news, Congress is on the verge of passing a $2 trillion emergency relief package for people and businesses affected by the COVID-19 pandemic. We'll find out how the parties appear to have struck a deal and where the money is slated to go. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, some state Republicans are criticizing Governor Evers for his rollout of his order telling Wisconsinites to stay at home, saying it caused confusion. Republican Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinke joins the show to share his perspective. First, the U.S. Senate is voting today on a $2 trillion relief package in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, which includes money for certain industries, enhanced unemployment benefits, new funding for the healthcare system, and direct payments to many Americans. It comes after several days of negotiation between Republicans, Democrats, and the White House. Early this morning, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced the agreement on the Senate floor.
At last, we have a deal. After days of intense discussions, the Senate has reached a bipartisan agreement on a historic relief package for this pandemic. It will rush new resources onto the front lines of our nation's healthcare fight, and it will inject trillions of dollars of cash into the economy as fast as possible.
If passed by the Senate, the legislation would then go to the House. A unanimous consent motion. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from Congress and the White House in response to this pandemic and offsetting the economic effects? What do you think the priority should be? Loans to industries to stay afloat? Money directly to individual people? How would this all affect you? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Jennifer Habercorn is a staff writer covering Congress for the Los Angeles Times. She's also a graduate of Marquette University. Jennifer, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Still being kind of hashed out and talked about in the Senate, what were some of the main sticking points coming from both sides here?
So they announced this morning that there was a deal, which came after, several days of negotiations between Republicans, Democrats, and the White House. Today, a couple last-minute snafus popped up. Several Republicans said they were concerned that unemployment benefits may actually be more than one salary in certain states, particularly states that have generous unemployment benefits. And Bernie Sanders responded and said that if Republicans try to block the bill, he would try to block the bill. So we're not at the finish line yet, but it is expected in the next couple days that this would pass. There was a lot of negotiation over the last few days. One of the big sticking points was about a $500 billion fund that the Treasury Secretary would use to help buoy corporations, particularly those industries that are in a lot of trouble because of the coronavirus, such as airlines and hotels. Democrats were concerned that there wasn't enough oversight on this fund and that the Treasury Secretary essentially would be allowed to hand over money to whatever companies he wanted and didn't have to disclose it for several months. Democrats were able to add some language, adding oversight, and also some unemployment benefits and hospital funding has been boosted in the final negotiations.
Now, before we dig deeper into this bill, can you remind us of what has been passed by Congress and signed by the president so far when it comes to economic relief over the COVID-19 pandemic?
Yeah, there's actually been two other coronavirus essentially bills. One addressed kind of how the government would respond, giving a lot of money to the CDC and state agencies. And then a second bill focused on boosting hospitals. This is the third bill, really designed to help individuals, families, corporations, and small businesses that are obviously, you know, everyone's shutting their doors in because of concern about spreading the virus, and this bill is designed to really boost them.
And when it comes to the idea of direct payments to people, straight up cash payments, what kind of things are we seeing in this agreement?
So as of now, it would provide $1,200 per adult and $500 per child, and those would go out to every American. They would phase out gradually, beginning at adjusted gross income of $75,000. It sounds like the IRS is going to base that on your 2018 taxes. Now, there is some concern that one's 2018 income could be dramatically different than their 2020 income, and it's a little unclear how that would be sorted out. But those payments could be made pretty quickly in some situations. The IRS could send direct payments through your bank account if you've done your taxes electronically in the past. That could come out pretty soon. If you need to rely on a paper check, or even an individual could get kind of like a debit card with their money on it, that would take a little more time. But we don't have exact details yet as to how soon that would come out. In addition, there's unemployment benefits. They're going to be more generous than they were in the past. It's going to be expanded to include freelancers, gig workers, and other furloughed employees. It'll be an additional amount of money and for an additional amount of time, another 13 weeks. And workers will get $600 per week for up to 4 months in addition to their regular unemployment benefits.
Talking to Jennifer Habercorn from the Los Angeles Times. She covers Congress. We're talking about the latest in economic stimulus efforts in Congress over the COVID-19 pandemic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Todd is with us in Oshkosh. Todd, hello.
Hello there. So I'm not sure exactly about the I guess it's called the stimulus package. They were talking about sending out monies to every individual or child. Is there an income limit on that?
Yes, that would end at $99,000 per individual, and I think that's $150,000 per couple. So, it would cap out. It would be based on your income.
Todd, thanks a lot for the call. And that, I know, had been a debate publicly, Jennifer, the idea that, okay, should we tailor this to get the money specifically to people that need it the most, or do we need a broader brush approach that we can do quickly? It sounds like we ended up somewhere in the middle.
That's right. And that was a big concern. There were some proposals that called for essentially giving every American a check. And, you know, there's a strong argument to be made that people who are making a lot of money don't need the help right now. It's the folks who are making minimum wage or laid off from their jobs who might need more help. So they came down with a flat amount, but it will phase out. So if you're at the upper end of that $75,000 phase down step, you're going to be seeing less than the $1,200 per person.
Thanks a lot for that call. Jennifer, I've been seeing reports that a few Republican senators, including Lindsey Graham, were objecting to the scope of the unemployment payments, worried that it would incentivize workers to want to be laid off or incentivize employers to lay off their workers. What do we know about that?
Yeah, so this just popped up in the last couple hours. Their concern is that by plussing up the unemployment benefits, that extra $600 per week that's available for 4 months, in some states that have generous unemployment benefits, you could essentially make more money by being unemployed and getting unemployment benefits than you would in your salary. So they're saying that they're going to object to this unless the Department of Labor is able to cap this somehow and make sure that there's that you could not make more being unemployed than employed. I'm not sure how that's going to shake out quite yet. No one does. And that's what's stalling this bill in the final vote today.
Let's bring on another caller at 800-642-1234. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hello.
Hi, Rob. I think this is an interesting illustration. I'm sure you've tasted Shep's ice cream in Madison, right?
I have done many times.
Right. Okay. Well, I used to deliver Shep's ice cream in northern Minnesota for 3 years. And when I was laid off a few years back due to circumstances, you know, that are regardless to this, my unemployment was only $350 a week. So getting that extra $600 in addition to your unemployment, I can totally see why some legislators are concerned that, yeah, I mean, lay me off during this time instead of keep me on the payroll. I'm going to get more money than I would if I were, you know, just going to keep working.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for keeping the ice cream flowing back in the day. Jennifer, have we heard arguments in response to Senator Graham and others and responding to Jeff's concerns?
Yeah, that's exactly the concern that Senator Graham has and the three other Republicans who are threatening to hold up this bill. On the opposite side, Senator Bernie Sanders has come out really strongly against Graham's position, said that, you know, this is exactly the time that you need to boost someone's unemployment benefits in a crisis like this. So, so again, I don't know how this is going to shake out. The kind of repair that's been floated by Republicans is that the Department of Labor would put a cap in place. So like the caller said, his salary was $300-something, or his unemployment benefits were $300-something, that he could get added to that, whatever the difference is between his unemployment benefits and his previous salary, and making sure it's not more than being employed.
Thanks for that call, Jeff. We'll go now to Peggy on the line in Casco. Peggy, hi.
Hello.
What do you want to bring up, Peggy?
I have a question that I don't think anybody has addressed yet. There are a lot of us out there who have credit card interest, and it runs anywhere from 18 to 26% or better. Is that going to be addressed with these credit card companies during this crisis?
Peggy, thanks for the call. I haven't heard anything about that, Jennifer, but is there anything like that or anything to deal with people who are in debt or maybe taking on debt in this time of an economic slowdown?
That hasn't happened at the federal level. I know that some states have talked about that, trying to work with credit card companies, or even some individuals have urged credit card companies. I'm not sure that anything like that's going to happen in law. But at the same time, we mentioned that this is the third coronavirus stimulus bill, and there's already discussion of a fourth and fifth bill. And one of the things that definitely has come up is what to do about folks who are facing credit card bills, mortgage payments, rent payments. A lot of those are going to be coming due as soon as April 1st, and there's definitely some interest on Capitol Hill to do something about that.
Peggy, thanks for that call. We're talking to Jennifer Habercorn, congressional reporter for the LA Times, looking at the latest coronavirus-related stimulus bill being voted on possibly soon in the Capitol. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see from Congress and the White House to help out economically with the impact of this pandemic? What would make a difference for you and your situation, for your community, maybe your business? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Jennifer Habercorn is with us, congressional reporter for the LA Times. It's our weekly look at the latest in news in national politics. The big story now, coronavirus economic relief efforts moving through Congress. We'll go back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Christine is with us in Eau Claire. Christine, hello.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. What I'm curious about is, you know, clearly there are going to be income limits for just regular working people, but what about the corporations who are getting bailed out? Are CEOs and other higher level people going to not get bonuses and all those things like we saw in the Wall Street bailout when Obama was president? That concerns me.
Christine, thanks for the call. I know that was a sticking point. Jennifer also concerns that, hey, are they going to, companies going to use money for things like stock buybacks? Where did that all shake out?
You're exactly right. That was a big issue. The updated bill language does have a prohibition on airlines in particular using stock buybacks and CEO bonuses with the money that they're going to get. They got a line item in this bill along with hotels for about $75 billion in economic relief, so they won't be able to do that. There are a couple other provisions in here to prevent stock buybacks in other industries that end up getting money, but it's not as it's not as firm as it is in this airline prohibition. There's also a conflict of interest provision inserted by Democrats that prohibits the Treasury from giving assistance to a fund to any company that is led by the spouse, child, son-in-law, or daughter-in-law of federal officials. There was concern that the Trump Organization would be a beneficiary of that fund, and that provision looks like it's there exactly to prevent that.
So that it applies to the executive branch. As I understand it, they extended that to include members of Congress as well?
Yes, I think so.
Let's take one more caller now. Joe is with us in Eagle River. Joe, hello.
Hi. Say, would retired seniors who are on Social Security be getting the stimulus checks or not?
Oh, interesting, Joe. What do we know about that, Jennifer?
You know, I'm not sure exactly how the Social Security is going to shake out, but I do know that the phase-out is going to be targeted to your adjusted gross income. So that would be the thing to look at, that line on your 2018 taxes.
All right, Joe, thanks a lot for the call. We've got Justin now on the line in Waukesha. Justin, hi.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to ask about, Justin?
I understand what Lindsey Graham is saying by, you know, people might be incentivized not to work if they potentially are going to receive more money from a stimulus package. But in the long run, wouldn't that also accomplish stimulating local businesses and local economies? It would incentivize people to be spending their money rather than holding on to the few pennies that they might have.
Oh, interesting. Justin, thanks a lot for the call. Jennifer, are people talking about that kind of, multiplier effect of this money flooding in to local economies?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was some of the argument that Bernie Sanders is putting forward, that this is the time when folks need money in their pocket. There's going to be, you know, in addition to folks who are not working, there's going to be additional expenses related to coronavirus that this is the kind of money that should be spent and would have an impact in the economy for sure.
Thanks for the call. We are talking to Jennifer Habercorn from the Los Angeles Times, looking at the latest news in national politics. Jennifer, we'll keep watching for a vote in the Senate on this thing. I want to move on to some other voting-related issues there in Congress. First of all, what is the U.S. House doing right now as they watch for this thing to clear the Senate?
So they're debating whether they like this bill or not. The Senate is still in Washington, but members of the House have gone back to their districts, so they're spread all over the country. The House does have the House requires that when they vote on legislation, that members have to be in the chamber, so they can't vote remotely by email or Zoom or any of these other new technologies that businesses are using in response to the coronavirus. So there's a method in which the House can approve legislation in an emergency like this. Essentially, everybody has to agree. Every lawmaker has to agree. That's called unanimous consent. It looks like they're not going to be able to get that because there's some folks on the far left and far right who don't like this bill. The other method is to do a voice vote. Just kind of say whoever's in the chamber, if more voices approve the bill, it passes. If more voices oppose the bill, it doesn't pass. And the problem that House Speaker Nancy Pelosi has to sort out right now is, are there enough members who like the bill who are willing to be in the chamber to approve it? Because if you have, you know, five or so members who don't like the bill and they all decide to come to Washington to get on a plane or hop in the car to voice their opposition, that could be a real problem. And then she'd have to call all 435 members back to Washington. That's a lot of folks getting on airplanes, exposing themselves and others potentially to COVID-19. And that's what Nancy Pelosi has to figure out how she's going to move forward. And that's assuming the Senate actually passes this bill sometime soon.
And that takes us to another issue you've written about recently, Jennifer, members of Congress trying to figure out if they can change things so they can vote remotely, given that we already have some positive tests for members of the Senate and Congress.
That's right. Like I said, right now, there's no way to vote remotely. And a lot of lawmakers are frustrated by that. You know, understandably, they think, you know, we have the technology. This is something that we should be able to do. The argument against it is that, one, it would be subject to cybersecurity attacks, and it would be hard to validate members' identification in that they're not being controlled by bad actors. You know, as of right now in the House, they vote with essentially a little ID card they stick in the chamber to press a button, essentially yes or no. And in the Senate, it's very old-fashioned. A member essentially raises their hand and gives a little signal to the clerk, a thumbs up or thumbs down, or even just a nod or a shake their head. But there is an effort because of coronavirus to get some electronic voting underway. In the Senate, there's about 17 supporters of this measure. In the House, there's more. As of right now, it doesn't look like it's going to happen in the near term, but there is quite a concern about getting that underway, if not for coronavirus, for some time in the future.
Right. There have been efforts in the past. I think I read this in your reporting to say, OK, can the Senate or the House convene in another place in times of a national emergency? There wasn't an effort to say if they're all in a different place, what do we do about that?
Right. Shortly after 9/11, there was a lot of talk about, you know, if Congress had to meet somewhere outside of D.C., where would that be? How would it work? But they haven't thought through, you know, what if lawmakers are generally safe but just spread all over the country? So, like I said, Congress generally moves very old-fashioned. I mean, in the Senate, you still can't have electronics on the Senate floor, and there are spittoons literally sitting in the Senate still. So this is a very old-fashioned institution, and the idea of emailing in a vote or holding a Zoom meeting is, very hard to imagine. But, you know, when we saw Senator Rand Paul announced his diagnosis on Monday, there was a lot of concern among senators that, you know, they could very likely be next. I mean, they're still meeting in groups of 100 senators. And we know that the CDC has said for many days now to not have a meeting of more than 10. So they know that they're putting themselves at risk somewhat unnecessarily by voting in this way.
Just a few seconds. I can't let this hang there. Have you witnessed the spittoons in operation, Jennifer?
No, I don't think they've been in operation for quite some time. But every time I see it, I can't help but think how how silly it is that it's still there.
Jennifer, thanks a lot for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Nice to talk with you.
Jennifer Habercorn is a staff writer covering Congress for the Los Angeles Times. She talked with us today about the $2 trillion spending package in Congress in response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Keep listening for our news breaks to see how that progresses through the Senate and, if it passes, then the House. If you're like a lot of people, the COVID-19 situation is interfering with your exercise program. Maybe not the biggest consequence, but it's out there. Even I'm feeling some of that. I am not, historically speaking, an exercise person, but I had been getting into swimming lately, but now for good reason, the places with swimming pools have closed down. I had my eye on a local lake the other day. The ice is gone, but I feel like it still might have been a bit on the chilly side for me. But here's an inspiring exercise story from France where people are dealing with a major lockdown. A furloughed restaurant worker ran a marathon on his apartment balcony. As reported by CNN, Alicia Nochomowitz is a marathon runner in the city of Balma, which is near Toulouse. He had run a few dozen marathons in the past, but the lockdown has shut down, of course, his training regimen. But he had determination and a 23-foot-long balcony. He says he ran about 3,000 laps to bring himself up to the 26-plus miles of the marathon. I haven't done the math on that myself yet. His time, not good by his standards, just shy of 7 hours, almost twice as long as his past record. Apparently, when you're always turning, it's tough to build up momentum and speed. His girlfriend was backing him up, supplying him with M&Ms and Coca-Cola to fuel his run. I can relate. I've got one of those fitness trackers, and I often end my day walking in circles in the house to hit my 10,000 steps by the end of the day. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network.